There's something about Elon Musk owning Twitter that's driving the media bonkers. His pledge to restore free speech to the platform has the so-called free speech industry flipping out.
Elon Musk has never been an advocate for free speech. He's an advocate for speech without consequences.
And when he's asked whether he's a free speech absolutist, and he says yes, I guess what does that mean?
When Elon Musk says, wow, this is about free speech, it seems to me that it's about free speech of straight white men.
If you get invited to something where there is total freedom for everybody, do you actually want to go to that party?
All their whining got us thinking. Why does a free speech Twitter scare the media? I'm Patrick Carelci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show.
This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks. Stories about everyday Americans that the globalists ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing. The truth. Welcome to Red Pilled America. It was December 2006. A cold but sunny San Francisco day when the founders of a scrappy social media startup sat down for one of their first interviews.
And today we're in the offices of Twitter.
Yes, we are. And please introduce yourself.
I'm Biz Stone.
Jack Dorsey.
Evan Williams.
Jack Dorsey was in a t-shirt and jeans. His two co-founders weren't buttoned up either. Their office was in a Bay Area borough called South Park. Not the Comedy Central show, but it might as well have been. Because the trio were in a process of making a community that would become just as politically incorrect as the cartoon city, maybe even more so. All three had something to say about their new creation, but Jack Dorsey, the guy who came up with the idea, appeared to be the lead spokesman for the project. He was the soul of the startup.
Well, can you tell us what Twitter is? Because some people who are watching may not even know what Twitter is.
Yeah, absolutely.
No. Twitter is a way to keep connected with your friends. It's basically mini blogging. It's a very low barrier to entry way to blog what you're thinking about.
I mean, how does it differ from a traditional blog, or how's it similar?
We have some different input methods, the major one being the phone. The other major constraint is we limit everything to 160 characters. So these are very short, focused updates, and they're usually personal, and they're usually about just random things you're doing during the day, instead of being a very composed article or right. You know, a normal blog post. But it's also right, about receiving what your friends are doing right now, right, which is the other side of it.
So we forgot to ask, what is the origin of the name Twitter?
If you look it up in the dictionary, it's actually like just short burst of activity, and it's something that birds do. It's just like chirping. So we felt that it fit our application perfectly because we limit each update to 160 characters. They're short, they're rapid, and they come all the time.
They were just a few months old. Very few people outside of the company were using the site.
So we're looking at my Twitter account, and I have 90 followers at the moment. So 90 people are watching what I'm doing and getting that update on their phone or on their IM client. And I have customized my account with this pretty red maroon background. We allow our users to just customize in a simple way. Background image, they can tile it, they can change the color of the links, they can change the sidebar color, and that's about it.
In those early days, Jack Dorsey had a very laissez-faire approach to moderation. In his view, the community would self-regulate.
I have been threatened, though, because it's so easy to use.
It's so easy to misuse.
So what is your recommendation for that? Like, you know, just
is there an
chill
FAQ
out,
question? How do newbies who have ADD use this product properly?
It just seems so it's just in my IM, you know, right there. So I'm just like, oh, going to get coffee in my kitchen or, you know, like what's the...
I think we've been finding that socially it works itself out. Like your friends are going to...
Just tell you to chill.
Yeah, sort of or they're going to stop following you and turn you off on the phone.
Yeah, turn you off, yeah.
There was no heavy hand, no kicking people off for saying too much. People would simply unfollow undesirable accounts. When it went live 9 months earlier, in March 2006, Twitter was behind in the social media game. MySpace was the reigning king of socials. Facebook had launched over 2 years earlier and was nipping at MySpace's heels. Yet Jack still had big hopes for his simple social media site. But in hearing him speak in those early days, it appeared that he didn't fully grasp what he'd built. Jack Dorsey and his co-founders had created one of the most disruptive communication tools in modern history.
We lost Oprah to Twitter.
Okay,
we
totally great. Okay.
She's gone.
Hi, it's Friday Live, and I'm on Twitter for the first time.
I am going to make history here as the first president to live tweet.
We're very excited because we've taken up the Twitter here on the Late Show.
Oh, no,
here it's fantastic.
Meryl, here's my idea, okay? So you are nominated, it's a record-breaking 18 times, right? So I thought we would try to break another record right now with the most retweets of a photo.
Well, I wanted to save my first tweet for the world's first reusable rocket.
Kim Kardashian tweeting, "What color is that dress? I see white and gold. Kanye sees black and blue. Who's colorblind?"
This all started with a single tweet that was posted by Vanity Fair magazine. And as you see it here, there's the picture. It shows Caitlyn, who was formerly known as Bruce Jenner, on the cover of the July issue.
I tweeted today, at Real Donald Trump, I tweet. And that's, you know, it solves them. Don't worry, I'll give it up after I'm president. We won't tweet anymore, I don't think.
This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
Let me tell you about Twitter. I think that maybe I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Twitter, because I get such a fake press, such a dishonest press.
Creating a backlash on Twitter. Pictures and video depicting comedian Kathy Griffin holding the bloody decapitated head of President Trump.
But the hashtag MeToo has already been tweeted nearly 500,000 times.
ABC has just issued a stunning statement, Wolf, that says the show has been canceled. I'll read you the two-sentence statement. Roseanne's Twitter statement, these racist remarks earlier in the day, are abhorrent, repugnant, and inconsistent with our values, and that we have decided to cancel her show.
I thought the bitch was white! God damn it!
Twitter trying to kill reports into leaked emails that were found apparently on the abandoned computer of Hunter Biden. When you try to click on to that story, the initial story in the New York Post on these emails, Twitter said, no, you can't, it's unsafe, and it banned you from retweeting links to it as well. And it locked even the New York Post's own Twitter account.
Twitter is meddling in the 2020 election. That's the only way of putting it.
Tonight, a deafening silence from the president's Twitter account in his waning days as commander-in-chief. Twitter, run by CEO Jack Dorsey, saying after close review of the president's recent tweets, it banned him due to the risk of further incitement of violence.
Twitter has launched massive social movements, exposed frauds, helped exonerate the innocent, ended political dynasties, and some believe it even meddled in an election. Jack Dorsey's creation has become one of the most powerful communication tools in America. But it really begs the question, what is this social media platform? Because it sure isn't just a microblogging site as its founders initially described.
To fully grasp what Twitter would become, you really need to understand how the site got its start and how the soul of the company, Jack Dorsey, seemed to stumble into building a revolution in media. We reached out to Jack Dorsey to be interviewed for this story. He didn't respond, but we've pieced together his story from the many interviews and speeches he's given throughout the years. Jack grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, and fell in love with the city.
And my parents always stayed in the city. They never moved out to the suburbs. They were true believers in the city, and St. Louis was one of the hardest hit cities in America, apart from Detroit, in the great flight to the suburbs in the 40s and 50s and the 60s. So when I was growing up, I was surrounded by this urban atmosphere, and I just loved it. My first love, I think, was the city and was walking around downtown St. Louis. And it was fairly desolate when I was growing up, but it was still a joy and a wonder to me.
To add to his urban love affair, at a young age, Jack developed an enthusiasm for computer programming. He'd eventually marry his two passions by writing programs that could draw city maps on a screen.
And then I put some dots on the map, and then I learned how to move the dots around. And then the next challenge was to figure out how to keep the dots on the streets, because they were kind of going all over the place. And then I had all these dots moving around this beautiful picture of this map, which represented downtown St. Louis, and then later represented New York City, which I was amazed by. And the issue was that none of the dots had any meaning whatsoever. They're just random dots moving around this city.
His parents had a CB and a police scanner. Jack was mesmerized by these two communication tools because ambulances and fire trucks and police cars and taxi drivers were constantly reporting where they were. So he figured out a way to take that information and input it into a program he'd written to have the dots on the map move with real-life meaning.
And I found all these open databases of this information. A lot of this was after the fact, but it was still interesting to watch and to see unfold. So now I had this picture of real live data of a real live city operating in front of me. And I just thought it was the most beautiful thing ever that I could visualize a city living and breathing.
He learned that there was a company that created the same kind of software. It was called Dispatch.
So I went to University of Missouri, Rolla, initially, and I was deciding between political science at the time and computer science because I've always been fascinated by cities and at some point went to maybe potentially go into government. Still not quite sure if I would have more effect there or more effect in programming.
Then he came to a realization. Writing government policy and writing computer programs were very similar. Both could get people to react. They could affect behavior.
But the difference is the time scale. So I could write a policy as, you know, as a senator or as a mayor, and I could see the effect maybe in 8 years. But I could write that same policy and write a simulator around it and write populations around it, and I could see that effect instantly with the computer. So I went down the computer science route. And all that time I was building this dispatch system because I was just fascinated by these cities and the visualizations.
He enjoyed the work, but it was lacking in one thing, humans.
But it was all verticals. There were no people in it. Where are all the people in the city?
The city visualizations showed objects moving around, but he wanted to be able to map and maybe even impact people's movement.
And that's when I started working on a very, very simple prototype based on some inspiration from Instant Messenger and also a service called LiveJournal, which was a very simple journal blogging application that allowed you to compose a blog post and it would go to a friend's page. And I also had the first BlackBerry because I was still working in dispatch at the time. It was called the RIM 850. And it was basically just an email pager. But what it allowed is I could be anywhere in the world, anywhere in the city, and I could share what I was doing. And maybe I could also see what other people were doing. So I wrote some very simple software to receive an email from my BlackBerry and then send it out to an email list of some people I put on that list. And I got that done in about a day, and then I went out to Golden Gate Park, and I went to the bison paddock, and I typed out an email that said, I'm at Golden Gate Park watching the bison. And I went out to my service and was broadcast out to all these people. And I immediately recognized two things. First, no one cared what I was doing. And second, no one else had a BlackBerry, so I was alone in my sharing and also receiving, so I was getting no information back. So, wrong time, good idea. Put it on the shelf.
Jack continued working for the dispatch company writing visualization programs, then went on to work random contract jobs until 2005 when he found a company called Odeo. Odeo was a tool that helped people create, record, and share the newest thing in media at the time, podcasts. The small but growing community of audio podcasts had no industry leader. Odeo was looking to be that.
I had no interest in podcasting whatsoever, but I was a really good programmer and I wanted to understand the consumer side of the internet.
The problem was that Odeo was about to meet one of the biggest tech juggernauts that has ever existed, and it was an encounter that their podcasting software wouldn't survive. Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So in 2005, Jack Dorsey went to work for a small podcasting outfit called Odeo. The company helped people create, record, and share a newfangled thing called podcasts. The problem was that Odeo was about to meet one of the biggest tech juggernauts that has ever existed, and it was an encounter that their podcasting software wouldn't survive.
How many of you here use an iPod?
That's Apple founder Steve Jobs at a 2005 conference called All Things Digital.
How many of you heard of podcasting? So let me start at the beginning and tell you what this is all about. Podcasting is a word that's concatenation of iPod and broadcasting, right? Put together podcasting. And what podcasting is, it's started off as Wayne's World for radio. Think of it that way, right? Where you've got anybody could make a radio show and put it on the internet and broadcast it out there and anybody else could listen to it. And then what you could do is, because people like to put out multiple episodes of their radio show, you could subscribe to a radio show. And every time it's updated, you'll get the update right on your computer and it'll go into your iPod when you sync your iPod, right? Pretty cool. What's happened since is that it's not just the Wayne's World of radio, but real radio is jumping onto this. And there's over 8,000 podcasts today. It's kind of interesting. There's no FCC regulation because you're not using spectrum. You're using the internet, so that makes it very simple. It's worldwide. You can put your radio show out there, and anyone in the world can listen to this. And if you Google podcast, 6.2 million entries in Google on podcasting, which is kind of fun. So, again, it's sort of like TiVo for radio for your iPod. So let me show you what it's like. This is the next release of iTunes called Release 4.9, and I'm just going to run it right now. And what we can do is we go to the music store, and there's a little thing called podcasts right here. You click that, and we've got a page full of podcasts right here.
Steve Jobs effectively legitimized the new media form. And with their entry into the podcasting business, Apple left Odeo without a sustainable business model. The company had to think of something else, quickly. So Odeo turned to its employees, including Jack Dorsey.
And we were given the assignment of come up with an idea of something you'd like to work on. And the first thing that came to my mind was this idea back in 2000. But now, in 2005, 2006, we had SMS.
We know of SMS today as texting.
I could actually send an SMS message from Singular to Verizon. And that was very, very new to the United States. And I was in love with the technology. It's, you know, it degrades gracefully to every single device, even the cheapest devices. And it has this beautiful constraint of 160 characters, and it doesn't really work all the time. And it's really rough around the edges. I love stuff like that. So I brought up this idea, what if we could just use SMS? You could send what you're doing. It would go out in real time to all the people who are interested in hearing it. And then it would be archived on the web. You could also enter it from the web, and it would be device agnostic, and it'd be a whole thing. It'd be awesome. And my two other people in the park, we were on a playground, said it was a good idea, and we presented it to the company. And took about a week, but then the company finally got behind it, and I was given 2 weeks, one other programmer, and Biz Stone to write the software end-to-end. And we did it, and at the end of that 2 weeks, I wrote the first tweet, which was inviting coworkers. And then all the Odeo coworkers came on, they loved it.
For the first few months, the Twitter team tinkered away with the platform, making modifications, then seeing how the small group of users reacted. They'd make seemingly little inane personal updates about their day, where they were, what they were doing. It was fun, even addictive. But it wasn't until one summer night that the true potential of Twitter was revealed.
On the evening of August 2, 2006, a small 4.5 magnitude earthquake centered about 50 miles north of San Francisco lightly shook the Bay Area. Twitter co-founder Ev Williams immediately took to his Twitter account and posted, "Did anyone just feel that earthquake?" A minute later, Jack Dorsey joined in posting, "Just felt that earthquake. No one else here did." It may have seemed like a small, unimportant event, especially to Californians who are used to far worse tremors. But in hindsight, it was a truly earth-shattering moment. Twitter was being used to give firsthand eyewitness accounts of what was happening on the ground. The team had accidentally stumbled onto the true power of their tool. It could be a news-gathering and spreading tool that could operate far faster than the legacy media, and without their filter.
By early 2007, the same company that wiped out their original podcasting project came up with another innovation that would catapult Twitter's popularity.
This is a day I've been looking forward to for 2.5 years. Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything. Apple's been very fortunate. It's been able to introduce a few of these into the world. In 1984, we introduced the Macintosh. It didn't just change Apple. It changed the whole computer industry. In 2001, we introduced the first iPod. And it didn't just change the way we all listen to music. It changed the entire music industry. Well, today, we're introducing three revolutionary products of this class. The first one is a widescreen iPod with touch controls. Second is a revolutionary mobile phone. And the third is a breakthrough internet communications device. So, three things: a widescreen iPod with touch controls, a revolutionary mobile phone, and a breakthrough internet communications device. An iPod, a phone, and an internet communicator. An iPod, a phone. Are you getting it? These are not three separate devices. This is one device. And we are calling it iPhone. Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
And Apple did just that. But it also helped launch 1,000 new services that would sit on the iPhone platform, one of them being Twitter. When the iPhone launched, Twitter was there to piggyback on its success.
Twitter was one of the more interesting of the big platforms, I think, because it's really a platform that succeeded because of the concept and the technology more than the marketing.
That's Alan Bakari, who investigates big tech for Breitbart News. He's also the author of Deleted, Big Tech's Battle to Erase the Trump Movement and Steal the Election.
So to contrast it with Facebook, Facebook had a really clever marketing strategy of going campus by campus and making it exclusive. It started off as a Harvard-only thing. Then it expanded to other campuses, and that slowly built hype over time. Every college campus was wondering when Facebook would come to it next. Twitter didn't do that. What they had was a very interesting concept. We're going to limit people to 140 characters, and we're going to see what people do with that. And that concept, that just became very, very addictive right away, and it immediately took off. They didn't have to do any clever marketing strategy with making it exclusive or anything like that. And I think it was particularly attractive to journalists because journalists love receiving information in small little bites. Journalists are always on deadline. They have to just get the most important facts and put it into their articles. They want things as brief as possible. So it instantly became the platform for journalists.
Journalists loved the tool. It gave quick insight, story ideas from the ground, and it came in short bursts. Twitter became the media industry's de facto dashboard. But what the media didn't realize at the time was that this new tool was going to challenge its gatekeeping status. Perhaps the first red flag displaying the power of Twitter came along in 2011. We've told the following story in detail in a previous episode, but it's worth telling an abridged version again here because it's crucial in understanding Twitter's evolution.
It was a Friday night, the beginning of Memorial Day weekend, when rumors began swirling that a rising Democrat politician had tweeted out a lewd image to an attractive young woman that was not his wife. Descriptions of the alleged tweet seemed designed for the tabloids.
Anthony Weiner, the congressman, had texted a picture of gray jockey shorts with a prominent bulge in them. He had tweeted that out and then immediately deleted it and announced that he was hacked.
That's Alex Marlowe. At the time, he was part of a team of rebel journalists led by new media pioneer Andrew Breitbart. By 2011, Andrew Breitbart had become a Jedi master of the Twitterverse, and everyone in the grassroots conservative movement knew it.
And people were sending Andrew screen caps and saying this really happened, though it had been deleted from the internet and things weren't captured quite as easily at the time. So we weren't 100% sure if it was real because it was gone and it was hard to check right away had this been tweeted because Twitter was not as big as it is now.
But this story, this lewd tweet from a congressman, sounded like a sex scandal. And that wasn't something that the team at Breitbart covered. However, there was one loose thread in the whole affair that caught Alex's eye.
But there was something that we all started to fixate on, and I was very vocal about this, that him tweeting that he was hacked was a massive problem. Because if a hacker is hacking into accounts of United States congresspeople and tweeting porn, or soft porn, light porn, whatever you want to call it, tweeting pictures of genitals, that is a story. That is not a sex story. That is a cybersecurity story now. And Wiener really backed himself into a corner with that tweet. If he had not tweeted that he had been hacked, who knows what would have happened? That was ultimately the tweet that made sure that we went forward with the story that night. And so we published.
Now, at the time, the mainstream media had a long-established strategy on dealing with salacious stories about Democrats. They'd just ignore them. But with the rise of new media, and now Twitter, they had to design a new tactic. Again, Alex Marlowe.
They started to attack Andrew, which was their playbook. They started to attack Breitbart, which is their playbook.
The person who reported it, Andrew Breitbart, has a history of taking Democrats out of context and smearing them.
I think we do need to point out that the person behind this is Andrew Breitbart, who has made a practice of targeting Democrats, and his stories tend to fall apart on close inspection.
It is a right-wing blogger who was pushing this, and a pretty unreliable one at that, which, you know, Mama always said, consider the source.
Look, Breitbart is a proven liar, okay? He doctored the Shirley Sherrod tapes. He's done this over and over again. Why would anybody take this fool seriously?
And they start shooting the messenger and acting as though Wiener is the victim of all this.
I'm inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt because this originated with Andrew Breitbart.
What Andrew Breitbart was insinuating about him with young girls and stuff is outrageous. And frankly, it's too bad that he got to say that stuff on CNN. Look, this is a lighthearted story. This is a silly little thing that happened. It's not a big deal.
The legacy media carpet-bombed the news airwaves with attacks on Andrew Breitbart, his character, and his conservative-leaning news operation. But after a few days of the story trending on Twitter, the media could no longer ignore it. This was Congressman Anthony Weiner, husband to Huma Abedin, Hillary Clinton's top confidant. Their marriage was even officiated by former President Bill Clinton. If the sitting congressman was hacked, the media had to at the very least feign interest. So, a few enterprising journalists decided to press Congressman Weiner on his claims.
Is that picture of you?
You know, look, I'm not going to talk about this anymore.
Why did you hire a lawyer? Why not let law enforcement just handle this if it's happening?
You know, put out a couple of statements over the last couple of days. I would refer you to those. They answer these questions, and I understand you're doing your job, but I'm going to go back to work now.
Can you say, though, if you're concerned about if there's hacking going on with members of Congress, I mean, that's a serious thing. I mean, aren't you concerned if somebody's looking at your sensitive information?
I'm going to return to working on the things I care about. You know, I've participated in the story a couple of days now, given comments on it. This is a distraction, and I'm not going to let it distract me.
Anyone watching the exchange could see that Congressman Weiner was deflecting. Deflecting on two simple questions. Were the pictures of him, and why hadn't he contacted Capitol Police to investigate the hacking of his Twitter account? The scandal came to be known as hashtag Wienergate. The hashtag was exploding on Twitter. CNN could no longer avoid the story.
Tonight, the questions Democratic Congressman Anthony Weiner is refusing to answer about a lewd photograph sent from his Twitter account to a 21-year-old college student. Conservative blogger Andrew Breitbart broke the story on Friday, and the next day, Weiner's office released a statement saying the congressman's Twitter account had been hacked, that he was the victim of a prank.
CNN sent out a few reporters to press the congressman on the issue.
You say that you were hacked, which is potentially a crime. So why haven't you asked the Capitol Police or any law enforcement to investigate?
Look, this was a prank that I've now been talking about for a couple of days.
I'm not going to allow it to decide what I talk about for the next week or the next 2 weeks. And so I'm not going to be giving anything more about that today. I think I've been pretty responsive to you in the past.
But you're not answering the questions. Can you just say why you haven't asked law enforcement to investigate what you are alleging is a
crime? You know, Dana, if I was giving a speech to 45,000 people, and someone in the back of the room threw a pie or yelled out an insult, would I spend the next 2 hours responding to that? No, I would get back. Well, why don't you do? What you want to do the briefing?
Do you want to do the briefing, sir? From your Twitter account, sir. A nude photograph was sent to a college student.
Sir,
answer the question. Was it from you or
sir.
Not?
Permit me. Do you guys want me to finish my answer?
Yes. This answer. Did you send it or not?
If I were giving a speech to 45,000 people, and someone in the back threw a pie or yelled out an insult, I would not spend the next 2 hours of my speech responding to that pie or that insult. I would return to the things that I want to talk about to the audience that I wanted to
talk to.
All
you have to do is say no.
And that is what I intend to do this
week. All you have to do is say no to the question.
Let me try this.
It was becoming glaringly obvious that Anthony Weiner was not telling the whole truth. Even the liberal late-night host could see it.
4 days ago, Representative Weiner's Twitter account sent a twit pic to a female college student over the Twitter. Now, I'm going to show you the photo right now. Yowza! How do you even tweet that thing? That is at least 150 characters.
While Weiner was finally being pressed by the media, Andrew Breitbart and his team were working on a lead. A different woman had sent a tip to his news organization claiming the congressman had sent her salacious pictures as well. Exactly 1 week after Wienergate kicked off, they tracked the Texas woman down. Shortly after talking to Andrew, she sent him pictures that Congressman Weiner forwarded to her. And this time, the images included Anthony's face within the frame of the photo. Weiner was toast. Andrew made his way to New York City to answer the swarm of media requests from this firestorm. And while he was en route, Breitbart News began slowly publishing the pictures, dripping them out one by one. Andrew essentially wanted Anthony Weiner to admit that Breitbart were not the hackers. The congressman could no longer claim ignorance. Breitbart News had the goods. When Andrew landed in New York City, he caught word that Anthony Weiner had announced a last-minute press conference. So instinctively, Andrew began walking to the Sheraton. He arrived to a hall packed with journalists waiting for Anthony Weiner to step to the podium. He stood quietly in the back of the room, and what happened next would go down in media history. Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So Andrew Breitbart and his team of rebel journalists were being accused by Anthony Weiner and the media of hacking the congressman's account. Andrew dug into the story and found another woman who'd received lewd pictures from Congressman Weiner as well. So, to get him to admit that Team Breitbart were not the hackers, Andrew slowly began publishing the photos. When Andrew landed in New York City to deal with the media firestorm, he learned that Anthony Weiner had called a press conference at the Sheraton. So Andrew made his way to the event. He quietly stood in the back of the room, but to his surprise, a reporter waved him up to the stage. The entire country had been captivated by Wienergate, so every significant media outlet in America was in the room. As word was spread across Twitter that Anthony Weiner was about to make an announcement, people began turning their TV dials to their trusted news stations. And what happened next went down in media history.
I'm Andrew Breitbart, by the way. We reported this at Big Government and Big Journalism.
Again, Alex Marlowe.
And somehow, Andrew got himself onto Weiner's podium and started to take questions from the media.
Mr. Breitbart, why did you put this on the web in the first place? What were you trying to achieve?
Well, it's clearly a news story. Why are you trying to challenge a news story? Look, we received a tweet that came from his official Twitter page sent out to a woman in Seattle. We did not go with the story until after we saw that the congressman took down all of his photos and the woman in Seattle took down her Facebook account and her Twitter account. And even worse, he went to his Twitter page to claim that he was hacked. We only wrote the story after a sitting congressman claimed that his computer system had been invaded by a hack. I've seen a lot of this congressman's body, and he's in very good shape, and it appears to be his body.
Moments later, Anthony Weiner made his way to the stage.
Last Friday night, I tweeted a photograph of myself that I intended to send as a direct message as part of a joke to a woman in Seattle. Once I realized I had posted it to Twitter, I panicked. I took it down and said that I had been hacked. I then continued with that story, to stick to that story, which was a hugely regrettable mistake.
The congressman hoped the story would die down. It wouldn't. The Wienergate hashtag continued to trend on Twitter. The media had lost control of the narrative and now had to continue to press the politician. On May 16, 2011, just a week and a half after his admission, Anthony Weiner called another press conference.
I had hoped to be able to continue the work that the citizens of my district elected me to do, to fight for the middle class and those struggling to make it. Unfortunately, the distraction that I have created has made that impossible. So today I am announcing my resignation from Congress.
Andrew Breitbart and his team of conservative journalists had taken out one of the Democrat Party's most beloved congressmen, and they did it using Twitter.
The whole affair would have massive implications, implications that would be revealed in due time. Conservatives were quietly becoming experts at using this new social media tool in a way that allowed them to bypass the legacy media gatekeepers and force inconvenient stories into the mainstream consciousness. It was not a widely acknowledged phenomenon at the time, but some began to pick up on the idea that Twitter was a threat.
When they write about this thousands and thousands and thousands of years from now, Twitter will be the indicator that it was the beginning of the end of civilization.
By the end of Wienergate, Twitter management had already gone through major turmoil. Jack Dorsey had been forced out as CEO and was in the largely figurehead position of chairman. The new CEO, Dick Costolo, underscored Twitter's company ethos at a tech conference.
You know, one of the things our general counsel always says, and he says it proudly, and I agree with him, is we're the free speech wing of the free speech party.
At the time, there was nothing controversial about the statement. It didn't raise the ire of anyone in media. People hadn't fully processed what Wienergate exposed. But in time, Twitter's free speech ethos would oddly become polarizing. In the years that followed, a few disruptive right-wing figures would adopt Twitter as their megaphone. They'd become extraordinarily effective at using the platform, so much so that it became apparent that the media was losing its grip on the narrative, and they'd have to do something about it.
Coming up on Red Pilled America...
I've been pretty mean through the years on
yes.
Twitter, but I don't think that's a reason to excise somebody from the platform.
And I think that was one of the very earliest things that started to push Twitter in the direction of censorship.
And then Twitter just locked our account, and they locked it for the next 2 weeks, and we only got it back just before the election.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by me, Adriana Cortez, and Patrick Carelci for Informed Ventures. Thanks for listening.